he adds with a laugh. That certainly wouldn't be good for business, I agree. Anyway, I won't keep you long. I just wondered if you saw Jack at all over the weekend, or at least spoke to him, because I haven't been able to get through to him and I'm beginning to get a bit worried. I know he told me that he wouldn't be answering his phone because of the press, but I thought he might pick up for me. Maybe he did for you? There's a bit of a silence. Are you saying that Jack is still in England? Yes, well, until tonight anyway. He's taking the evening flight, remember? Well, at least I hope he is. He did say he might not be able to get here until Thursday, but I didn't think he really meant it. The trouble is, I can't get through to him. Grace, I had no idea Jack was here. I thought he was in Thailand with you. I thought he left on Friday evening, after the case. No, he made me come on ahead. He said he wanted to get all the paperwork out of the way first, that he couldn't bear the thought of having to face it all when he came back. Well, I understand that, I suppose. There's nothing worse than coming back from holiday and finding a backlog of work, and it's always harder when it concerns a case that you've lost. I guess he must be feeling pretty low. You could say that, I admit. As a matter of fact, I've never seen him so down, which is why I wanted to stay with him. But he said he preferred to be on his own, that if I was around, it would take him longer to get through everything, and then we'd both miss out on our holiday. So, here I am. Between you and me, I never understood why he took the case on in the first place. Maybe he let his emotions get in the way, I suggest. But the thing is, Adam, you must have known he was staying behind, because didn't you offer to take him to the airport this evening? When? Well, on Friday, I presume, when he told you he was staying behind. Sorry, Grace. I'm afraid I haven't spoken to Jack since Friday morning before he left for court, although I did leave a message on his voicemail, commiserating with him over losing. Are you saying that you haven't heard from him since you left? Yes. I wasn't too worried at first because he warned me he wouldn't be answering his phone, and anyway, I was away on an excursion for the last couple of days. I expected him to have at least left a message on my phone here at the hotel to tell me that everything was on schedule for tonight. He may already have left for the airport. You know what traffic is like in rush hour. But I keep getting through to his voicemail. I know he won't answer the phone if he's driving, but it's really frustrating. Maybe he's forgotten to switch it back on again if it's been off since Friday. Maybe. Listen, Adam, I won't take up any more of your time. I'm sure everything's fine. Do you want me to phone around a few people and see if they've spoken to him at all over the weekend? Would that put your mind at rest? Relief floods my voice. Yes, it would, definitely. You could try Esther. When she took me to the airport, she said she'd invite Jack around sometime over the weekend. Will do. Thanks, Adam. How are Diane and the children, by the way? They're all fine. Let me make those calls and I'll get back to you. Can you give me your number there? I read it out to him from the hotel notepad, which is lying on the bedside table, and sit down on the bed to wait. I try to read, but I find it difficult to concentrate. Half an hour or so later, Adam calls back to tell me that he hasn't found anybody who actually spoke to Jack over the weekend, although several people saw him in the office before he left for court. I've also tried him several times myself, but I got his voicemail each time, as did Esther when she tried to get hold of him. But that doesn't mean anything. As I said, maybe he's just forgotten to switch it back on again. I don't think he would have, especially as he must know that I'll be wanting to speak to him. And there's something else I thought of. Why did he tell me that you'd offered to take him to the airport when you didn't? Maybe he intended to ask me to, then changed his mind. Look, don't worry. I'm sure everything's all right. I'm sure he'll be on that flight tonight. Do you think that if I phone British Airways in a couple of hours, they'll tell me whether or not he's checked in? No, they won't. Not unless it's an emergency. Passenger confidentiality and all that. Then I guess I'll just have to wait until tomorrow morning, I sigh. Well, when you see him, Make sure you tell him off for worrying you. And tell him to send me a text to let me know he's arrived. Then could you give me your mobile number? He gives it to me, and I jot it down. Thanks, Adam. Once again, I have trouble sleeping. Early next morning, prettily dressed and beautifully made up, I go down to the lobby. Mr. Ho is once again at the reception desk. He guesses that I've come down to wait for Jack and tells me that I might have a long wait as there are the queues at passport control to contend with, plus the taxi ride from the airport. He suggests that I have breakfast, but I tell him that I prefer to wait for Jack, that he'll no doubt be hungry when he arrives. I find a seat not too far away from the main door and settle down to wait. As time goes on, I look at my watch anxiously and, when it's evident that something's wrong, I go over to Mr. Ho and ask him if he can find out if the London flight arrived on time. He checks on his computer and, when he tells me that the flight was in fact delayed and is due to land at any moment, I can't believe my luck, because I won't have to pretend panic for another couple of hours. Mr. Ho smiles at the look of relief on my face, and I admit that I was beginning to worry at Jack's non-appearance. I go back to waiting, and Mr. Ho brings me over a cup of tea to help pass the time. When, almost 2 hours later, Jack still hasn't arrived, it's time to start feeling uneasy. I ask to use the phone at the reception desk, and as I dial Jack's number, I tell Mr. Ho that although Jack had warned me he might only be able to make the Wednesday evening flight, I can't help feeling worried, because he would have phoned to let me know. When I get through to his voicemail, my voice is shaky, with tears of disappointment and frustration. Jack, where are you? I know the flight was delayed, but you should be here by now. I hope it doesn't mean that you're not arriving until tomorrow. If that's the case, you could have at least warned me. Have you any idea how worrying it is to be without any news from you for the last 4 days? Even if you didn't want to answer your phone, you could have phoned me. You must have got all my messages. Please give me a ring. Jack, it's awful being stuck here, not knowing what's happening. Not that I'm not being well looked after, I add hurriedly, aware that Mr. Ho is listening. Because I am, but I just want you here. Please, phone and tell me what's happening. I'm in the lobby now, but I'll be going up to my room, or you can leave a message with Mr. Ho at reception. I love you. I hang up to find Mr. Ho looking sympathetically at me. He suggests that I go through for breakfast, and when I tell him that I'm not hungry, he promises to call me if Jack phones. So I let him persuade me to have something to eat. As I make my way to the terrace, I bump into Margaret and Richard, the couple I met the day before on the trip to the temples, and my eyes fill with tears of disappointment when I explain that Jack hasn't turned up. They tell me not to worry, pointing out that he had warned me he might be delayed, and insist that I spend the day with them. I tell them I'd rather stay in the hotel for the next couple of hours in case Jack phones or suddenly turns up, but that I'll join them in the afternoon if he doesn't. I go up to my room and phone Adam. I'm relieved when he doesn't pick up, as it suits me to leave a message, letting him know that Jack wasn't on the flight. Later, I go down to join Margaret and Richard, the strain of not having heard from Jack clearly visible on my face, especially when I tell them that I've tried his mobile again several times without success. They are kindness itself, and I'm glad to have them to take my mind off things. I punctuate the time I spend with them with fruitless calls to Jack's mobile, urging him to phone me. In the evening, my new friends refuse to let me sit and mope alone, so we have dinner together, where they talk brightly about how much they're looking forward to meeting Jack the following morning. I eventually get back to my room around midnight and find a message from Adam saying he's sorry he missed my call and asking if I would like him to go over to the house to see if Jack is still there. I phone him back and tell him that yes, if he doesn't mind, But then we work out that if Jack is to catch the flight that evening, he will already have left for the airport. So I tell him not to bother, and that I'll phone him the moment Jack arrives. And we joke again about the telling off he's going to get for worrying us all. The next morning, Margaret and Richard keep me company while I wait for Jack to arrive from the airport, so they are there to witness my distress when he doesn't turn up. At Margaret's suggestion, I try to find out from British Airways if Jack was on the flight, but they are unable to help me. So I phone the British Embassy. I explain everything to them, and maybe because Jack's name is known, they tell me they'll see what they can do. When they phone back and confirm that Jack wasn't on the flight, I burst into tears. I manage to pull myself together long enough to tell them that he doesn't seem to be at home either, but although they are sympathetic, they tell me there isn't a lot they can do at this stage. They suggest I phone friends and relations in England to see if they know where he is, and I thank them and hang up. With Margaret by my side, I call Adam and, my voice trembling with anxiety, tell him what has happened. He immediately offers to go straight round to the house and calls me back half an hour later to say that he's standing outside the gates, but that everything is shut up and nobody has answered the bell. So I worry that Jack has had an accident on the way to the airport, and although he reassures me, he says that he'll make some inquiries. I tell him that the British Embassy suggested I try to find out if anyone has spoken to him since I left, and he offers to phone around for me. While I wait for Adam to get back to me, Diane calls to reassure me and to tell me that Adam is doing all he can to track Jack down. We talk for a while, and after I've hung up, Margaret begins to ask me gentle questions, and it dawns on me that she and Richard are wondering if there could be someone else in Jack's life, someone who he might have run off with. Horrified, I tell her that it had never occurred to me, because there had never been anything in his behaviour to suggest that there was, but that I suppose it's a possibility I'm going to have to consider. The phone rings again. Grace? Hello, Adam. I make my voice hesitant, as if I'm dreading what he's going to tell me. Have you managed to find out anything? Only that Jack hasn't been admitted to any of the hospitals I've phoned, which is good news. It is, I agree, giving a sigh of relief. On the other hand, I phoned as many people as I could think of, but no one seems to have heard from him, at least not over the last few days. So I'm afraid we're back to square one, really. I look at Margaret, who nods encouragingly. There's something I need to ask you, Adam, I say.
Go on.
Is it possible that Jack was having an affair? Maybe with someone at the office? My words come out in a rush.
An affair? Jack?
Adam sounds shocked. No, of course not. He would never do anything like that. He barely looked at another woman before he met you, and he certainly hasn't since. You must know that, Grace. Margaret, who gets the gist, gives my hand a squeeze. I do, I say, chastened. It's just that I can't think of any other reason he would suddenly disappear without a trace. Can you think of any other friends he has? People that maybe I don't know? Not really, I say. Wait a minute, what about Moira and Giles? You know, the people who were at Millie's party. Maybe you could contact them? I don't have their number, though.
Leave it with me. What's their surname?
Kilburn Hawes, I think.
I'll give them a ring and get back to you, he promises.
He calls back half an hour later, and when he tells me that they haven't heard from Jack either, I become distraught. Nobody seems to know what to do. The general consensus, from Margaret, Richard, Adam and Diane, is that it's too early to launch a missing persons inquiry, so they tell me that the best thing to do would be to try and get some sleep and see if Jack turns up the next morning. He doesn't. The day passes in a blur as Mr. Ho, Margaret, Richard and Adam take over.
I tell them I want to go home, but they persuade me to stay for one more day in case Jack turns up. So I do. In the early afternoon, 8 o'clock in the morning in England, Adam calls to say that he's spoken to the police and that, with my permission, they'll be happy to break into the house to see if they can find anything to indicate where Jack might have gone. They call me first and ask me to run through the last time I saw Jack, and I tell them that it was when Esther came to pick me up to take me to the airport that he had waved me off from the study window. I explain that he hadn't been able to drive me to the airport himself because he'd had quite a large whiskey when he'd come in from work, and add that I hadn't particularly wanted to leave for Thailand by myself, even though Jack had warned me, when the Tomasin case began to look as if it would overrun, that I might have to. They say they'll get back to me as soon as they can. And I sit in my room and wait for them to phone, with Margaret by my side, holding my hand. I know the news I'm waiting for is going to be a long time coming, so after a while, I tell Margaret that I'd like to try to sleep and lie down on the bed. I manage to sleep until the moment I've been waiting for since I arrived in Thailand finally comes. It begins with a knock on the door and, because I don't move, Margaret goes to answer it. I hear a man's voice, and then Margaret comes over to the bed and, with a hand on my shoulder, gives me a little shake, telling me that there's someone to see me. As I sit up, I see her slip out of the room and I want to call her back to tell her not to leave me, but he is already walking towards me, so it's too late. My heart is beating so fast, my breathing so shallow that I don't dare look at him until I've managed to compose myself. With my eyes fixed firmly on the ground, it's his shoes I see first. They are made of good leather and are well polished, just as I would expect them to be. He says my name, and as my eyes travel upwards, I see that while his suit is dark, in keeping with the occasion, it's made of a lightweight fabric because of the climate. My eyes reach his face. It's pleasant, but grave, just as it should be. "Mrs. Angel," he says again. "Yes?" There's a trace of anxiousness in my voice. My name is Alistair Strachan. I'm from the British Embassy. He turns, and I see a young woman standing behind him. And this is Vivian Dashmore. I wonder if we could have a word? I jump to my feet. Is it to do with Jack? Have you managed to find him? Yes. Or rather, the police in England have. Relief floods my face. Oh, thank goodness for that. Where is he? Why wasn't he answering his phone? Is he on his way here? Perhaps we could go and sit down, the young woman suggests. Of course, I say, ushering them through to the sitting room. I sit down on the sofa and they take the armchairs. So where is he? I ask. I mean, is he on his way here? Mr. Strachan clears his throat. I'm very sorry to have to tell you this, Mrs. Angel. But I'm afraid that Mr. Angel has been found dead. I stare at him, my eyes wide with shock. Confusion floods my face. I don't understand, I stammer. He shifts uncomfortably. I'm afraid your husband has been found dead, Mrs. Angel. I shake my head vigorously. No, he can't be. He's coming here to join me. He said he would. Where is he? My voice trembles with emotion. I want to know where he is. Why isn't he here? Mrs. Angel, I know this is very difficult for you, but we need to ask you some questions, the young lady says. Would you like us to fetch someone? Your friend, perhaps? Yes, yes, I nod. Can you get Margaret, please? Mr. Strachan goes to the door. I hear the murmur of voices, and Margaret comes in. I see the shock on her face, and I begin shaking uncontrollably.
They're saying that Jack's dead, I say. But he can't be. He can't be. Oh, it's all right, she murmurs, sitting down next to me and putting her arm round me. Oh, it's all right.
Perhaps we could have some tea brought up, the young woman says, getting to her feet. She goes over to the phone and speaks to someone in reception.
Did he have a car crash?
I ask Margaret, sounding bewildered.
Is that what's happened? Did Jack have a car crash on the way to the airport? Is that why he's not here?
I don't know, she says quietly.
He must have,
I go on, nodding with conviction.
He must have been rushing to catch the flight. Oh, he must have left the house late and was driving too fast and had a crash. That's what happened, isn't it?
Margaret glances at Mr. Strachan.
I don't know, I'm afraid.
My teeth begin chattering.
Oh, I'm cold.
She jumps to her feet, glad of something to do.
Would you like a jumper? Is there one in your wardrobe? Yes, I think so. Not a jumper, a cardigan maybe. The bathrobe? Can I have the bathrobe?
Yes, of course. She goes into the bathroom, finds the bathrobe, comes back and puts it around my shoulders.
Thank you,
I murmur gratefully.
Is that better?
She asks.
Yes, but Jack can't be dead. It must be a mistake. It has to be.
She's saved from saying anything by a knock at the door. The young woman opens it and Mr. Ho comes in, followed by a girl pushing a laden tea trolley.
If I can be of further assistance, please let me know,
Mr. Ho says quietly. I sense him looking at me as he leaves the room, but I keep my head bowed. The young woman busies herself with the tea and asks me if I would like sugar.
No, thank you.
She places a cup and saucer in front of me, and I pick up the cup, but I'm shaking so much some of the tea slops over the side and onto my hand. Scalded, I clatter the cup back down onto the saucer.
Sorry,
I say. Tears fill my eyes.
I'm sorry.
It's all right, says Margaret, hurriedly taking a paper napkin and mopping my hand. I make an effort to pull myself together.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name,
I say to Mr. Strachan.
Alistair Strachan.
Mr. Strachan, you say that my husband is dead.
I look at him for confirmation.
Yes, I'm afraid so.
Then can you please tell me how he died? I mean, was it quick? Was anyone else hurt in the accident? Where did it happen? I need to know how it happened.
It wasn't a car accident, Mrs. Angel.
Not a car accident,
I falter.
Then how did he die?
Mr. Strachan looks uncomfortable.
I'm afraid there's no easy way of saying this, Mrs. Angel. But it seems that your husband took his own life.
And I burst into tears. Past. Once I'd realised that I could get away with murder, I spent the rest of the night working out the details, thinking of ways to get Jack exactly where I needed him to be when the time came. Because my plan hinged on him losing the Tomasin case, I took a leaf out of his book and planned for every eventuality. I thought very carefully about what I would do if he won, and, in the end, I decided that if he did, I would drug him anyway, and, while he was unconscious, phone the police. If I showed them the room in the basement, and the room where he kept me, maybe they would believe what I told them. In the event that I didn't manage to drug him before we left for the airport, I would somehow get the pills into him on the plane, and try to get help once we arrived in Thailand. Neither solution was brilliant,
but I didn't have any other options. Unless he lost. And even then, there was no guarantee that he would bring up a glass of whiskey to commiserate. The next day, the day of the verdict, I spent the morning crushing the remaining pills into as fine a powder as I possibly could and hid it in a screw of toilet paper, which I pushed into my sleeve, as I would a tissue. When I eventually heard the whir of the black gates opening and the crunch of the gravel as Jack drove up to the front door sometime in the middle of the afternoon, my heart began hammering so hard I was afraid it would burst out of my chest. The time had finally come. Whether he had won or lost, I was going to have to act. He came into the hall, closed the front door and activated the shutters. I heard him open the cloakroom door, walk across the hall to the kitchen, followed by the familiar sounds of the freezer opening and closing, the ice cubes being popped from the tray, the cupboard door opening and closing, the clink as the ice cubes were dropped into one glass. I held my breath. Two glasses. His footsteps as he came up the stairs were heavy and told me all I needed to know. I began rubbing my left eye furiously so that by the time he unlocked the door it would be red and inflamed. "Well," I asked, "how did it go?" He held out a glass to me. "We lost." "Lost?" I said, taking it. Without bothering to answer, he raised his glass to his lips and, scared he would knock the whole lot back before I'd had a chance to drug him, I jumped off the bed. "I've had something in my eye all morning," I explained, blinking rapidly. "Could you have a look?"
"What?"
Could you just look at my eye a moment? I think there must be a fly in there or something." As he peered into my eye, which I kept half shut, I worked the paper holding the powder from my sleeve and into the palm of my hand. "So what happened?" I asked, unscrewing it as best I could with my fingers.
"Dina Anderson screwed me over," he said bitterly.
"Can you open your eye a bit more?" Keeping my movements small, I moved the glass I was holding in my other hand under the paper and shook the powder into it. "Oh, I can't, it's too painful," I told him, stirring the contents around with my finger. "Can you do it? I'll hold your glass for you." With a sigh of annoyance, he handed me his glass and pulled my eye open using both hands. "I can't see anything." "If I had a mirror, I'd be able to do it for myself," I grumbled. "It doesn't matter. It'll probably work itself out." He held out his hand for his glass, and I gave him mine. "What shall we drink to?"
"Revenge," he said grimly.
I raised the glass I was holding. "To revenge, then." I knocked half of the whiskey back and was gratified to see him doing the same.
"Nobody makes a fool out of me. Anthony Tomasin is going to suffer for this too."
"But he was innocent," I protested, wondering how I was going to keep him talking until the pills took effect.
"What has that got to do with it?"
As he raised his glass to take another drink, I was alarmed to see tiny white specks floating in the whiskey.
"Do you know what the best part of my job is?"
"No, what?" I said quickly.
"Sitting opposite all those battered women and imagining it was me who'd beaten them up."
He knocked the rest of his glass back.
"And the photos, all those lovely photos of the injuries. I suppose you could call it one of the perks of the job."
Incensed, I raised my glass, and before I could stop myself, I had thrown the rest of my whiskey in his face. His roar of anger, plus the knowledge that I'd acted too soon, almost paralysed me, but as he lunged towards me, his eyes shut tight against the sting of the whiskey, I took advantage of his momentary blindness and pushed him as hard as I could. As he stumbled awkwardly against the bed, the few seconds before he righted himself were all that I needed. Slamming the door behind me, I ran down the stairs to the hall below, looking urgently for somewhere to hide, because I couldn't let him catch me. Not just yet. Upstairs, the door crashed back against the wall, and as he came pounding down the stairs, I headed for the cloakroom and climbed into the wardrobe, hoping to buy myself a few precious minutes. This time, there was no sing-song in his voice as he called for me. Instead, he roared my name, promising such harm to me that I trembled from my hiding place behind the coats. Several minutes passed, and I imagined him in the sitting room, checking behind every piece of furniture. The waiting was unbearable, but I knew that with every minute that passed, the chances of the pills taking effect increased. At last, I heard the unmistakable sound of his footsteps coming down the hall. My legs turned to jelly, and as the cloakroom door opened, I found myself sliding to the floor. The silence that followed was terrifying. I knew he was there, outside the wardrobe, and I knew he knew I was inside. But he seemed content to leave me to sweat, relishing, no doubt, in the fear emanating from every pore of my body. I don't know when it occurred to me that the wardrobe might have a key, but the thought that at any moment he could turn it in the lock and imprison me there made it impossible for me to breathe. If I couldn't put the next part of my plan into action, there would be no saving Millie. Blind with panic, I flung myself against the doors. They burst open and I fell into a crumpled heap at Jack's feet. His rage as he pulled me up by the hair was tangible, and afraid that he might harm me physically, I began screaming for mercy, telling him I was sorry and begging him not to take me down to the basement, gabbling incoherently that I would do anything as long as he didn't lock me in there. The mention of the basement had the desired effect. As he dragged me back along the hall, I struggled so hard that he had no choice but to pick me up, and I let myself go limp so he would think I'd given up. I used the time it took for him to carry me to the room he had prepared so carefully for Millie to focus on what I needed to do, so that when he tried to throw me down, I held on to him as hard as I could. Enraged, he tried to shake me off, and as he cursed me loudly, the slur in his voice was all that I needed. Still keeping hold of him, I allowed myself to slide down his body towards the floor, and when I reached his knees, I yanked them towards me as hard as I could. His legs buckled immediately, and as he swayed above me, I used every ounce of strength I possessed to send him crashing to the floor. Stunned by the fall, his body heavy from the pills, he lay without moving for a few precious seconds, and before he could recover, I fled the room, slamming the door behind me. As I ran towards the stairs, I could hear him hammering on the door, yelling at me to let him out, and the fury in his voice made me start sobbing with fright. Reaching the hall, I kicked the door that led to the basement with my foot, shutting it against the noise. Taking the stairs two at a time, I ran to my bedroom, retrieved the glasses from where we had thrown them, and carried them down to the kitchen, trying to ignore Jack's desperate attempts to get out of the room below by focusing on what I needed to do. With shaking hands, I washed the glasses, dried them carefully, and put them back in the cupboard. Hurrying back upstairs, I went to my bedroom, straightened the bed, removed the shampoo, sliver of soap and towel from the bathroom, and carried them into Jack's bathroom. Stripping off my pyjamas, I put them in the laundry basket, went into the bedroom where my clothes were kept, and got dressed quickly. I opened the wardrobe and took a couple of pairs of shoes from their boxes, some underwear, and a dress, went back to the master bedroom, and placed them around the room. On returning to the dressing room, I picked up the case that Jack had made me pack the night before and went downstairs. I wasn't worried about getting out of the house. I didn't need a key to open the front door. but I was worried about how I was going to get to the airport without any money. I knew that Jack had probably hung the jacket he had worn that morning in the cloakroom, but I didn't want to rifle through his clothes for money, and hoped I would come across some while I was looking for my passport and tickets. I opened the door of his study and turned on the light. When I saw both passports and tickets lying neatly on his desk, I almost cried with relief. There was an envelope beside them, and opening it, I found some Bart. With the sleeve of my cardigan over my fingers, I slid open one of the drawers, but I couldn't find any money, and I didn't dare rifle through the other drawers. Taking my ticket, passport, and the Bart with me, I went back into the hall, and because I couldn't get to the airport without money, I went into the cloakroom, found his jacket, opened his wallet as carefully as I could, and took out 4 £50 notes. I was about to close his wallet when his business cards caught my eye, and remembering that at some point I would need to phone his office, I took one. Realising that I had no idea what the time was, I went back to the kitchen and looked at the clock on the microwave. I was alarmed to see that it was already 4:30, around the time I would need to leave for the airport on a Friday night for a check-in at 7. In all my careful planning, I hadn't actually thought about how I would get to the airport. I suppose I'd had a vague idea of taking a taxi, so it was galling to realise that I had no idea what number I should call to order one. Public transport was out. The nearest train station was a 15-minute walk away, and I was loath to draw attention to myself by wheeling a heavy case along the road, and anyway, I doubted it would get me there in time. Aware that I was wasting precious time, I went back to the hall and picked up the phone, wondering if such a thing as an operator still existed. As I stood there, wondering what number I should dial, Esther's came into my head, and, hardly daring to believe that I had remembered it correctly, I called her, praying that she would pick up. "Hello?" I took a deep breath. "Esther, it's Grace. Am I disturbing you?" "No, not at all. I was just listening to the radio, actually. Apparently, Anthony Tomassin was acquitted." She paused a moment as if she wasn't quite sure what to say. "I guess Jack must be disappointed." My mind raced. "Yes, I'm afraid he is rather." "Are you all right, Grace? You sound a bit upset." "It's Jack," I admitted. "He says he can't leave for Thailand tonight as he has too much paperwork to do. When he booked the tickets, he thought the case would be over long before now, but because of the new evidence about Dina Anderson having a lover, it overran." "Oh, you must be so disappointed. But you can always go later, can't you?" "That's just it. Jack wants me to go tonight, as planned, and says he'll join me on Tuesday once he's got everything sorted out. I've told him that I'd rather wait for him, but he says it's stupid to waste both tickets. He'll have to buy a new one for Tuesday, you see." "Ah, I take it you don't want to go without him." "No, of course I don't." I give a shaky laugh. "But in the mood he's in, maybe it would be better. I meant to be phoning for a taxi to take me to the airport. He can't take me because he had a hefty whiskey when he came in. Trouble is, I don't have a number for one, and I don't dare disturb Jack in his study and ask him if I can use the computer to look for one. So I was wondering if you knew of a local firm." "Do you want me to take you? The children are already home from school, and Rufus worked from home today, so it wouldn't be a problem." It was the last thing I wanted. "Oh, it's very kind of you, but I can't ask you to drive to the airport on a Friday night," I said hastily. "Well, I don't think it'll be that easy to get a taxi at such short notice. What time do you need to leave?" "Well, as soon as possible, really," I admitted reluctantly. "I have to check in at 7. "Oh, then you'd better let me take you." "I'd rather take a taxi. If you could just give me a number." "Look, I'll take you. Really isn't any trouble. Anyway, get me out of the dreaded bath time." "No, it's fine. Why won't you let me help you, Grace?" There was something about the way she said it that put me on my guard. "I just think it's an awful imposition, that's all." "It isn't." Her voice was firm. Have you got all your stuff ready? Yes, we packed yesterday. Then I'll just go and tell Rufus I'm taking you to the airport and I'll be straight over. Say, 15 minutes? Great, I told her. Thank you, Esther. I'll tell Jack. I put the phone down, appalled at what I'd just agreed to. I couldn't even begin to imagine how I was going to be able to pretend to someone like Esther that everything was all right. Present. The air hostess leans towards me. We'll be arriving at Heathrow in about 40 minutes, she says quietly. Thank you. I feel a sudden urge of panic and force myself to breathe calmly, because I can't afford to crack at this stage of the game. But the fact is, even though I've thought about nothing else since Margaret saw me through passport control at the airport in Bangkok almost 12 hours ago, I still have no idea how I'm going to play it when we finally land. Diane and Adam will be there to meet me and take me back to theirs. So I need to think very carefully about what I'm going to say to them about my last hours with Jack, because whatever I tell them, I'll have to repeat to the police. The seatbelt sign comes on, and we begin our descent into Heathrow. I close my eyes and pray that I'll end up saying the right thing to Diane and Adam, especially as it's Adam who's been liaising with the police since Jack's body was found. I hope there aren't going to be any nasty surprises. I hope Adam isn't going to tell me that the police think Jack's death is suspicious. If he does, I don't know what I'll say. All I can do is play it by ear. The problem is, there are so many things I don't know. The euphoria I felt when Mr. Strachan told me that Jack had taken his own life, because it meant that my plan had worked and I had got away with murder, was quickly tempered by the fact that he'd used the word seems. I didn't know whether he'd decided to be cautious of his own bat, or if the police in England had intimated that there was room for doubt. If they had already started questioning people, work colleagues, friends, maybe they'd come to the conclusion that Jack was an unlikely candidate for suicide. The police were bound to ask me if I knew why Jack had taken his own life, and I would have to convince them that losing his first court case was reason enough. Maybe they would ask me if there'd been problems in our marriage, but if I admitted that there had been, even if I gave them all the details, they would surely consider murder rather than suicide. And that is something I can't risk. Mr. Strachan told me that Jack had died from an overdose, but he didn't give me any more details, so I don't know where his body was actually found, and I hadn't thought it appropriate to ask. But what if Jack had a way of getting out of the room in the basement? What if there was a switch hidden away somewhere that I hadn't found? What if, before actually succumbing, he'd made it up the stairs and into the hall? He might even have had time to write a note implicating me before he died. Not knowing means I'm ill-prepared for what's to come. Even if all went to plan and Jack was found in the basement, the police are bound to ask me why the room existed, what its purpose was, and I can't work out if it'll be in my interest to admit that I knew about it all along, or deny all knowledge of it. If I admit that I knew about it, I'll have to make up some story about it being the place Jack used to go to before he went to court, to psych himself up and remind himself of the worthy work he did as defender of battered wives. I'd rather deny all knowledge of it and profess shock that such a room could exist in our beautiful house. After all, as it was hidden away at the back of the basement, it's feasible that I hadn't known about it. But then I'm faced with another dilemma. If, for some reason, the police have fingerprinted the room, they might have found traces of my presence there. So maybe it would be better to tell the truth. But not the whole truth. Because If I portray Jack as anything other than the loving husband everybody thought he was, if I tell them the real purpose of the room, they might begin to wonder if I murdered him to protect Millie. And maybe a court would be sympathetic. Or maybe they would make me out to be some kind of gold digger who'd killed my relatively new husband for his money. As we begin our descent into Heathrow, the importance of making the right decisions, of saying the right thing, weighs me down. It takes a while to get through passport control. As I go through the double doors, I scan the faces of people waiting, searching for the familiar faces of Adam and Diane. I'm so tense that I know I'll probably burst into tears of relief when I see them, which will be in keeping with my role as a bereaved wife. But when I see Esther waving at me rather than Diane, a feeling of dread comes over me. "I hope you don't mind," she says, giving me a hug. "I didn't have anything to do today, so I offered to pick you up and take you to Diane's. I'm so sorry about Jack." "I still can't believe it," I add, shaking my head in bewilderment, because the shock of seeing her waiting for me has dried up the tears I'd been hoping to shed. "I still can't believe he's dead." "It must have been such a shock for you," she agrees, taking my case from me. "Come on, let's find a cafe. I thought we'd go for a coffee before we start on the journey home." My heart sinks even further, because it's going to be so much harder to play the grieving widow in front of her rather than Diane. "Wouldn't it be better to go straight back to Diane's? I'd like to speak to Adam, and I need to get down the police station. Adam says the detective looking after the case wants to talk to me." "We'll only get stuck in rush hour at this time of the morning, so we may as well have a coffee," she says, heading towards the restaurant area. We find a cafe, and she makes a beeline for a table in the middle of the room, where we're surrounded by noisy school children. "Sit down, I'll go and get the coffees. I won't be long." My instinct is to flee, but I know that I can't. If Esther has come to pick me up at the airport, if she has suggested coffee, it's because she wants to talk to me. I try not to panic, but it's hard. What if she's guessed that I murdered Jack? What if there was something about my behaviour the day she drove me to the airport that aroused her suspicions? Is she going to tell me that she knows what I've done? Is she going to threaten to tell the police? Is she going to blackmail me? I watch her paying for our coffees, and as she heads back to where I'm waiting, I feel sick with nerves. She sits down opposite me and places my coffee in front of me. "Thank you." I give her a watery smile. "Grace, how much do you know about Jack's death?" she asks, opening her sachet of sugar and tipping it into her cup. "What do you mean?" I stammer. "I presume you know how he died." "Yes, he took an overdose." "He did," she agrees, "but that's not what killed him." "I don't understand." "It seems that he misjudged the amount of pills he would need and didn't take enough. So he didn't die, well, not from the overdose anyway." I shake my head. "I don't follow." "Well, because he didn't take enough pills to kill himself, he regained consciousness." "So, how did he die then?" "From dehydration." I summon a look of shock to my face. "Dehydration?" "Yes, about 4 days after he took the overdose." "But if he wasn't dead, if he was still alive, why didn't he just go and get a drink of water if he needed one?" "Because he couldn't. His body wasn't found in the main part of the house, you see. It was found in a room in the basement." "A room in the basement?" "Yes. The worst thing is,
It couldn't be opened from the inside, which meant he couldn't get out, even when thirst took hold.
She picks up her spoon and stirs her coffee.
Seems he tried to, though.
Poor Jack, I say quietly.
Poor Jack.
I can't bear to think about how he must have suffered.
Did you have any inkling that he would do such a thing?
No, not at all. I would never have left him otherwise. I would never have gone to Thailand if I'd thought he was going to kill himself.
So, how was he when he came back from court?
Well, he was disappointed about losing the case, of course.
It just seems that it seems completely out of character for him to take his own life. At least, that's what people might think. So he was probably a bit more than disappointed, don't you think?
I mean, wasn't it the first case he'd lost?
Yes, it was. So he must have been devastated. Maybe he even told you that he felt his career was over. But you thought it was just something he'd said in the heat of the moment, so you didn't really take any notice.
I stare at her.
Isn't that what he said, Grace? Didn't he say that he thought his career was over?
Yes, I nod slowly.
He did say that.
So that must be why he wanted to kill himself, because he couldn't stand failure.
It must have been.
I agree.
It also explains why he was so eager for you to leave. He wanted you out of the way so that he could take the pills. It seems that he took them not long after you left. Do you know where he got them from? I mean, does he sometimes take sleeping pills?
Sometimes. I improvise.
They weren't prescribed by a doctor or anything. He just bought them over the counter. They were the same ones that Millie was taking. I remember him asking Mrs. Goodrich for the name of them. The fact that he knew the door to the room in the basement couldn't be opened from the inside shows that he realised he might not have enough pills but was determined to kill himself, she says. She takes a sip of her coffee. The police will almost certainly ask you about the room. You knew about it, didn't you? Because Jack showed it to you?
Yes. She fiddles with her spoon.
They'll also want to know what the room was for.
For the first time, she seems unsure of herself.
It seems that it was painted red, even the floor and ceiling, and that the walls were hung with paintings of women who'd been brutally beaten.
I hear the disbelief in her voice, and I wait. I wait for her to tell me what I should say to the police. But she doesn't, because she has no explanation to offer me, and the silence stretches out between us. So, I tell her what I came up with on the plane.
Jack used the room as a kind of annex, I say. He showed it to me not long after we moved into the house. He said he found it useful to spend time there before he went to court, going through the files, looking at the photographic evidence. He said it took such an emotional toll on him that he found it difficult to prepare mentally in the house, which was why he had created a separate study in the basement.
She nods approvingly.
And the paintings?
I feel a surge of panic. I'd forgotten all about the portraits Jack had forced me to paint for him. Esther looks steadily at me, forcing me to focus.
I didn't see any paintings. Jack must have hung them later. I suppose he didn't show them to you because they were so graphic he didn't want to distress you.
Probably, I agree. Jack was wonderfully caring that way.
They might ask you if you knew the door couldn't be opened from the inside.
No, I only went down there once, so it wasn't something I would have noticed. I look at her across the table, needing confirmation that it would be the right thing to say.
Don't worry, Grace. The police are going to go easy on you. Remember, Jack told them you were mentally fragile, so they know they have to be careful.
She pauses.
Perhaps you should play on that a little.
How do you know all this? About how Jack died, where his body was found, the portraits, what the police are going to ask me?
Adam told me.
It's going to be all over the papers tomorrow, so he thought you should be prepared.
She pauses a moment.
He wanted to tell you himself, but I told him that, as you and I were the last people to see Jack alive, I felt it should be me who came to get you at the airport.
I stare at her.
The last people to see Jack alive?
I falter.
Yes. Yes, you know, last Friday, when I picked you up to take you to the airport. He waved goodbye to us after we'd put your case in the boot.
He was at the study window, wasn't he?
Yes,
I said slowly.
He was.
And if I remember rightly, you told me that he didn't come out to the gate to wait with you because he wanted to get straight down to work. But what I can't remember is whether he was wearing his jacket or not.
No, no, he wasn't.
He wasn't wearing his tie either. He'd taken it off when he came back from court.
He waved us goodbye, and then he blew you a kiss.
Yes. Yes, he did.
The enormity of what she's doing, of what she's offering to do, hits me, and I feel myself starting to shake.
Thank you, I whisper.
She reaches across the table and covers my hands with hers.
It'll be all right, Grace. I promise.
Tears well up from deep inside me.
I don't understand.
Did Millie say something to you? I mumble, aware that even if she had, even if Millie had told Esther that Jack had pushed her down the stairs, it wouldn't be reason enough for her to lie for me.
Only that she didn't like George Clooney, she smiles.
I look at her in bewilderment.
Then why?
She looks steadily back at me.
What colour was Millie's room, Grace?
I can barely get the word out.
Red,
I tell her, my voice breaking.
Millie's room was red.
That's what I thought, she says softly. The end. You've been listening to Behind Closed Doors by B.A. Paris, narrated by Georgia Maguire.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.